before I moved to my neighborhood, I was not a Christian. I wasn't a guy who even liked God. Actually, I despised God at the time. When I moved onto the street, I didn't know anybody. It was about 16 homes, the dead-end street. I started talking quickly to one of my neighbors. Our first meeting was very, hey, how you doing? And it was very superficial, I guess. And it really just over time, just hello became how you doing, became how's your day, became, hey, so what do you do? He invited me over for a drink and a cigar. Went over to his house and another gentleman showed up. They asked me what my story was. And I pretty much showed them what my story is and where I came from. And for most of my years, it was me against the world. When I would have good things happen to me, it's because of my hard work. I worked really hard to make the money that I made, to set the life up that I had. I had a lot of material things. Now through that, I was never happy. I was never excited about my life. I asked him, you know, about his story. When he told me his story, I said, you know, why do you do the things that you do? And then he showed me the Bible where it says, Jesus says, do these things. And I got to watch him, particularly that night, tell me, but then throughout the weeks and months that I've known him, he actually lives out what the Bible preaches. Guys on my street, they invited me into a small group. There's like four or five of us that have been meeting for about 2 years now. So I got to actually see these guys tell their stories, and they were just as broken as I was. Not ever liking the Lord really did leave me something empty inside. I did not know that though until someone asked me, hey, come to church, see what we do. And once I started that, and then started in my neighborhood, listening to other people who were in my neighborhood, other people who were of God and wanted to be more like God, that's when I started feeling my heart get excited and fall in love with A, the Lord, but B, fall in love with my wife and fall in love with being a husband, a father. I asked my neighbor to baptize me because he helped lead me to Christ. He helped by showing me the examples of how to live. If my neighbors would not have reached out to me and would not have wanted to share their faith with me, at this point in time, I'd be in hell. I would be in a very bad spot in my life. I'm not sure if I'd be married. I'm not sure what my life would be if that neighbor wouldn't have reached out to me.
Man, good stuff. Good stuff. I know David. I didn't know him back, several years ago, but from what I talk with other people about, he's a different dude. He's a different dude. And so this sort of exemplifies what we're looking at in this series, Backyard Gospel, inviting people into the backyards of our lives, having normal relational conversations, and allowing the gospel to come out. As we looked at last week, the gospel is a New Testament word. It's in the Bible, but it's actually a word that predates the New Testament. It's an ancient word that simply means good news. Good news. And anybody who shares the good news is in ancient times known as an evangelist. Yes, an evangelist is in the Bible, but it is not a biblical word. It predates the New Testament. We think today of an evangelist as somebody who's, you know, got a cheap haircut, bad suit, and a bad attitude. But that's really not what an evangelist is. It's somebody who has received something of value and wants to share it. And in here, we have all different sorts of spiritual orientations, people who have seen Jesus as God, the Son of God, others of us in here who don't have much respect for the Bible at all, but we're trying to just see what that might be like if we did have respect. I just want to let you know, no matter who you are, no matter where you are in your faith journey, it's awesome to have you here. And specifically, some of us, we're not going to be sharing the gospel of Jesus Christ that we're talking about in this series, but hopefully as we talk about it, you might see Jesus in levels in ways that you really haven't before. It's really not about proselytizing or having some big debate about whose spirituality and whose religion is right. It's not that. It's being able to notice that Jesus has done something in my life, and I want to share that. Last week, I talked about naturally sharing good news with people of things that have impacted my life. I talked about auto insurance, and I gave somebody a really free advertisement last week of an auto insurance company. I've been getting emails all week saying, oh my gosh, you're right. I say 50%. Oh my goodness. It is. And I actually wonder, I should have prearranged with them to get a cut of all the action. I mean, 15,000 people. I gave brand new advertisements to everybody. I should have gotten a cut of the action. I didn't, but it doesn't matter because you know what? I'm excited when you get the good news of saving money. but nowhere near as excited as when I see somebody get the good news of seeing that God cares about you and loves you so much, he actually put on flesh, he identified with you, lived as a model for you, and died for you and I for the problems and sins that we have in our life. And therefore, I want to naturally talk about that in an unoffensive, natural backyard way. Jesus said, take the gospel into all the world, meaning all the realms that we operate in, into the sports areas, into commerce, into the civic associations, just where you are naturally shared in a normal backyard way, what Jesus meant to you and your life. And many of us do this in various ways. The book of 1 Corinthians talks about the different roles that happen when someone comes to see God for who he is. It says this, he who plants and he who waters are one, and each will receive his wages according to his labor, for we are God's fellow workers. I have a faith in Christ right now, but this faith didn't all of a sudden spontaneously appear. There was people who planted ideas in me. There were others who watered before it actually came up through the ground. And finally, as I came up through the ground, there were people who reaped or harvested, were able to take me the final 10%. And all of us are in different stages of that process if you're here today. But it's work. It's work. It doesn't happen naturally. Speaking of work, I know that my job is a little unusual. Every once in a while when I'm talking about something here from stage, I realize what I'm saying right now, I'm just different. I'm weird. My work, I get my paycheck from a church. Very few people in here get their paycheck from a church. And so sometimes I can talk about ideas and you could justifiably say, yeah, dude, that's easy for you to say, but like I'm in the real world here. I'm in the real world. How would you possibly know what it's like to actually talk about your faith in the normal work environment that I'm in? Great point, great call. You're exactly right. So therefore, I have reinforcements today. I've actually asked a good friend of mine to spend the rest of our time, rest of his teaching time talking with us. He's a really good and close friend. He came in entry level at Procter & Gamble, and now he is a president at Procter & Gamble, el presidente at Procter. Well, maybe not. How many presidents are there at Procter & Gamble? 20. So you're not that special then. 20. So Uno los presidentes then. Is that right? Uno los, what's that, eighth? Whatever, I'm close. So he's got a lot of good insights to help us. I've benefited every time from hearing him. So please welcome my great friend, Kirk Perry. Yes. Did you take Spanish class? Oh, did that sound right?
I don't think that was Spanish, Brian. I don't know what you were saying. Right, okay. Yeah. Good morning. I don't know what to do after an intro like that. Well, I am thrilled to be talking with you about a subject very near and dear to my heart, which is sharing faith at work. And the reason I very simply believe that is I spend the majority of my waking hours at my place of employment. And you know what? If you do the math in your head, most of you in this room will do exactly the same thing. So can you imagine a world where, let's say you have kids or a spouse or dogs or favorite sports teams, where people said, you cannot bring any of the stuff in your life that you love, that's a part of who you are, into the workplace. Keep it out. Keep it separate. Can you imagine the majority of your waking hours being spent there? What that would feel like if that's, in fact, the world we live in? And I very much think about my own situation where faith is a huge part of who I am. And if I weren't able to share that at work, I wouldn't be bringing who I am to work every day. So I had an eighth grade shop teacher who used to say that to show it, you gotta know it. And what he meant by that was, if you're gonna teach somebody how to do something, know how you learned it yourself, so you can meet people where they are and help them get there. So what I wanna start off by doing is sharing what I call my personal faith journey. And this really will kind of encapsulate the first 33 years of my life, and I'm gonna share with you in those first 33 years what I call my four mistaken faith beliefs. Now, why are they mistaken and why am I sharing them with you up front? Well, they really formed what I believed about faith for those first 33 years. But a single event happened which completely overturned those, and I'll share that as well. So if I go way back and start with my personal life, I grew up in Detroit, Michigan, one of four kids, the oldest of four kids, and my parents had three of us by the time they were 21 years old. That was back in the old days for you younger folks. And I remember distinctly, I had the opportunity to be around my grandparents growing up, but a couple of faith things that came out of that. One is, I never remember having a single conversation with my grandparents about faith. I never went to church with my grandparents. My wife, on the other hand, had the seeds of faith planted in her by her grandmother. For my own nuclear family, my mom and dad, we hardly ever talked about God or Jesus ever. I remember, though, when people would and talk about it out loud, my dad would call them Bible beaters, Bible thumpers. Those are the words that I heard about people who talked about their faith in a very public way. There was a period of my early life when my parents both lost their jobs. They were blue-collar workers at Ford Motor Company, and we went on welfare for a period of time. And I remember we went to church when we were desperate. I remember that. We didn't talk about it, but we went when we were desperate. So the mistaken faith belief number one that came out of that was faith is private. Faith is private. You don't share your faith. Because if you do, you're going to share something that is supposed to be just between you and God. That's what I took away from my very early memories in life. And you know what? If someone up to that point in my life, early high school, call it, would have asked me what my faith was or what I believed, I would have had that deer in the headlights look, that look of fear and trepidation that I get every once in a while when my wife will say to me, "Honey, do these new jeans make my butt look big?" Now, every guy in the room can relate to that because nothing you say after that makes any sense whatsoever. Nothing you say. Or worse yet, if someone would have said to me, "Pray out loud," it might have looked a little something like this. So when I was in high school the last couple years, my mom and dad started going to church, and they made me go. They made me go. So I went every Sunday for a couple of hours, and during that 2 hours, I was very moral, and I was very religious, and I was very holy. But honestly, for the rest of the 166 hours left in my week, I was anything but. I was anything but. And when I looked around, my friends, and even their parents, were doing the exact same thing. So when I looked at that, I said, man, my mistaken faith belief number two that was ingrained in my brain at that time was, as long as you show up on Sunday, that's really showing your faith. That's really showing your faith. So when I went on to college, I am a proud University of Cincinnati Bearcat. All right, there we go. There we go. A few cats in the crowd today. I remember distinctly, and again, this is another old era thing, the TUC Bridge. I remember walking across the TUC Bridge, and this guy flagged me over, and he was standing there with a friend. He said, "Hey, I think we're in the same accounting class together." I didn't recognize him, but, you know, there's usually 200 people in a class at UC, so that wasn't unusual. As we started chatting, he, in essence, invited me to a small group. He said, "You know, we get there, we talk about God, we talk about Jesus, and, you know, that's how we grow together." And I remember because of the first two things I just mentioned, I'm like, "Oh, I'm not so sure about this." And he started talking to me more and said, "You know, we'd love you to come." I said, I'll think about it. And as I was starting to walk away, he said, "Hey, one more thing. Are you born again?" I'm not sure. What does that mean? And he went on to explain it. And so he asked me, you know, "Were you immersed or were you sprinkled?" I said, "Well, I don't know. I was little. I think they sprinkled me. I don't remember getting dunked." He said, "Well, you realize that to be born again, you have to be immersed. And if you're not immersed so that God can redeem your sin, you're going to spend eternity in hell." And I remember those words were blazing on my forehead. "See you later, man. Have a great day." Never saw him again. But it led to my mistaken faith belief number three, that sharing your faith was really scaring people into believing. You know, this was brought home to me a few years ago when I attended the granddaddy of all college football bowl games, the PapaJohns.com Bowl in Birmingham, Alabama, where my beloved Bearcats were playing before they got on a good bowl run. And there's a picture here that I took as we were queuing up outside of the stadium to get in. You'll notice the unusual nature of that line. It looked sort of like a square. And the reason for that square is because, see the guy standing there? He got the bullhorn at his side. The back of his shirt, if you can't read it, says, "Know Your Bible." And for the 10 to 15 minutes we were queued up there, he was exhorting us to come to Jesus, to know God, to be baptized, to do all of the things that were true and factual, or we would spend eternity in hell. Now, God loved him for having the guts and the courage to go out and do that. God love them. But I'll tell you what, that isn't the way to reach me. That isn't the way to connect with my heart. And for the 10 to 15 minutes, what I heard really from people were jeers. There were no cheers for Jesus. There were jeers. And so, again, this whole idea of sharing my faith and scaring people into believing was something that I came to believe. So when I started at Proctor, I was a 22-year-old undergraduate, my first professional job. I started in the marketing organization, and first week I was there, I had lunch with a guy who'd been with the company over 30 years, and I said, hey, I'd love to pick your brain and know what it takes to be successful here, what works here, and over the next hour, I got incredible insight that really helped my career. And at the very end of it, though, he said there are three things you absolutely need to stay away from when you're at work. Romance, politics, and for all good measure, stay away from religion here. And he emphasized that twice. So that led to my mistaken faith belief number four, that faith and work don't mix. Faith and work don't mix. So for the first 33 years of my life, these are the four things that I believe. Now, you may be seeking the Lord. You may be seeking to know who Jesus is, and you may resonate with one or more of those or all of those. And that's very much the place I was in, because up here, I definitely believed in God. Intellectually, I believed in God, but in my heart, I really didn't. I did not have a relationship with God or Jesus. So, that event that changed my life. On July 20th, 1999, I found out that my oldest of four kids, who is now a 19 and a half year old rising sophomore at the University of Alabama, Roll Tide. There we go, I got a few. There we go, Roll Tide. We found out on July 20th, that 1999, that she had kidney cancer. And that was literally a jolt that any of you who had any illness in your family or illness with your kids, you'll know that it's something that you just never expect and never really expect to endure. And so we were actually living overseas at the time, and my wife happened to be home for the summer, and so our lives got turned upside down. We were living in South Korea. We had to move a lot of our stuff back here. She had her kidney taken out. She started her chemotherapy. She was 6 years old at the time. And I remember coming home from work about 3 weeks into this whole process, and my daughter Carly was literally writhing on the floor in pain every 10 minutes, almost like labor pains. We rushed her down to Children's Hospital. This was a Monday night. They admitted her. They put a tube down her throat to drain everything out of her stomach because she couldn't keep anything down. They gave her a morphine drip every 10 minutes to keep the pain from coming back, which lasted about 2 minutes. And we literally did not sleep that whole week. So on Saturday morning, I pulled all the doctors together because we had surgeons, we had oncologists, and we had gastroenterologists all saying something else was going on with her. And so I said, guys, if we can't figure this out today, I'm going to put her in a car and I'm going to take her to Johns Hopkins, or I'm going to go to the Cleveland Clinic someplace, but we have to figure out what's going on. So they rushed her down for an MRI and they brought her back, and I'll never forget the patter of footsteps literally running down the hallway. And it was a team of doctors, and they flagged my wife and I out in the hall. They said, I'm sorry, we have some bad news for you. We think your daughter, from her surgical adhesion where they removed her kidney, has a perforated colon. And we're going to have to take out part of her colon. We're going to have to leave her wound open to heal. And we're going to have to put a colostomy bag on her. And I was like, are you kidding me? She is 6 years old. What kind of a God lets this happen to a six-year-old kid? And so I remember we literally rushed her down to the operating room. And as we were waiting to go into the operating room, the anesthesiologist came over and put a vial of morphine into her chest port. And she was holding on, he said, I can't give her any more. And as she was holding onto her hands, my wife and I were across from each other. She squeezed my hand and said, Dad, you have to take this pain away from me. I can't take it anymore. And she said, God, Jesus, if you're there, you have to take this away. I can't. And she's 6 years old. As I'm standing there with tears streaming down my cheeks, I had to watch my daughter get wheeled into the operating room, not knowing what was going to happen. Over the next 4 hours, they told us she'd be having the surgery. So my wife and I went out to an empty waiting room on a Saturday night. 45 minutes later, the doctor, remember this, kicks open the door, and he had his surgical gloves on, and he's still dressed like he was in surgery. And he said, "Hey, great news, great news. She didn't have a perforated colon. We had to take part of it out because it was blocked, but we sewed her back up, we stitched her up. She's back in recovery, and you can go see her in a few minutes." My wife and I literally fell to the floor weeping, and I'm not a very emotional guy, but we literally fell to the floor weeping. And you have to understand who my wife is to really appreciate this story, but she was the rock throughout this entire process. She was the one who kept steady when all was turmoil around us. In fact, there were a couple times when she literally slapped me across the face to calm me down. So she is one tough woman. I always teased her and said she wore a barbed wire bra during this whole process. But she said something in that moment which literally changed my life. She said these exact words. She said, "Can you imagine how God must have felt when his son was hanging on that cross? He had the power to stop it, but he didn't. He didn't. We would have given our lives to stop her pain, but we couldn't. He loved us that much. You know, God let his son die for our sins so we didn't have to." It literally was a lightning bolt that hit me from above. God was screaming at me in terms of how much he loved me, how much he wanted a relationship with me. And it was only in that moment of my lowest point did I really see who God was, did I really feel the presence of Jesus. It was because my wife had the wisdom and the strength to see through the tragedy, the triumph of Jesus hanging on that cross and dying for me. So as I think about my faith journey, I know that single moment was when I bore fruit, when I blossomed into a believer. But I know along the way, there were people that planted into me who changed my life, who planted seeds, who poured water. And they were people like Jim Bechtel. Jim is one of the founders of this church. Jim and I worked together at Procter & Gamble. In my early years, Jim reached out to me and invited me to a small group lunch Bible study. And at that point in my life, as I told you, I certainly wasn't open to that. But there was something different about Jim, something different about his aroma. I wanted to be like Jim. I wanted to be more like Jim. I wanted to get to know Jim. And he really planted the seeds of faith in me. Or people like Dennis Beausejour, who was our chief marketing officer at the time. And when I was deciding whether or not I was going to go overseas with my family, I met with him and we had an hour-long conversation. At the end of that, he said, "Have you prayed about this?" And I remember, did he just say pray about this in a business meeting? And it was shocking, right? I mean, I had senior-level officer of the company asking me if I'd prayed about something. But I look back, and in that moment, I realized they had planted seeds and they'd watered me so that in this moment, I was able to bear fruit. So when I think about sharing my faith at work, one of the things I talk about with my organization is I talk about my job is what I do, but my faith is who I am. My faith is who I am. I want people to say, what's different about that guy? Like I thought about Jim Bechtel or Dennis Beausejour, what's different about them? I want to know more about them. I want to be a seed planter because you know what? None of us converts anybody to Jesus. None of us. We plant the seeds and we water, and God and Jesus do it in their own time. They bring people at their time and at the place they intend for them. Not my plan, not your plan, not anybody's plan, but it's God's. It's God's plan. I want to have the fragrance of Jesus, and I want to allow people to smell it without being overwhelmed. I don't want to be the guy with the bullhorn. I want to be the guy with the right word at the right time. So, in the New Testament, book of Matthew, chapter 5, verses 13 to 16, here's what Jesus tells us. "You are the salt of the earth, but if the salt loses its saltiness, how can it be made salty again? It is no longer good for anything except to be thrown out and trampled underfoot. You are the light of the world. A town built on a hill cannot be hidden. Neither do people light a lamp and put it under a bowl. Instead, they put it on its stand, and it gives light to everyone in the house. In the same way, let your light shine before others, that they may see your good deeds and glorify your Father in heaven." I love these metaphors of salt and light. You know, here, by show of hands, how many of you salt your food before you eat it? Come on, be brave. All right. I get in trouble for this all the time, but I love salt. I love the flavor it gives the things I put it on. And for me, the metaphor is so powerful because salt is so tasty to me. And when I see salt or when I taste salt in others, I want more of it. I want more of it. And the light metaphor is powerful for me because I'm a runner. And my favorite time to run is I love leaving the house before the sun comes up. Because in the darkness, things look very different. But on my way back, on my loop, the sun is coming up. And the world looks so different and beautiful compared to the darkness when I left. So I love this metaphor of light really illuminating things. And that's what Jesus calls us to be the salt and the light of the earth. So there's four ways that I share my faith at work. And you know, we call them at work false objections. Like when people think about sharing their faith, things pop into your head like, well, I'm not a biblical scholar. Or, you know what, if I expose myself, if I let people know I'm a believer, then they see my faults, then they're going to turn away from religion because they're going to see me as a hypocrite. But you know, when you read the Bible, you read about the heroes of the Bible being regular dudes, just like me, who happen to be blessed to work for a great company and have a great job, but regular people who have flaws, who have flaws. Look at King David. He was an adulterer and a murderer, but he loved God and chased him every single day. God used him to glorify him. And so I'm heartened by the fact that I can be, and I fall short every day of the man God wants me to be. I make mistakes every single day, as I'm painfully made aware of every single day. And I fall short every single day, and I strive to be close to God because he has grace and he wants to pull me in, so he wants to use me. So these four things, they may resonate with you, they may not. That's okay. That's cool. It's where you are, and I'll just share with you because they're real examples to me. The first one is, show your faith is a natural part of who you are, as your own story. You know, at work, a lot of times people talk about being lucky. Oh, I'm lucky. Luck, this happened because of luck, or that was lucky. Luck implies you had a lot to do with it, or just things happened. But I tend to use the word blessed. I tend to use the word blessed because blessed implies God was a part of it. Blessed implied God was a part of it. So I try to use language that's consistent with what I believe. The other thing I do is when people are going through a very difficult spot, I'll say to them, I want to pray for you. And I'll pull out my phone and I'll put in their name or family member, whoever's going through a difficult time. Say, you know, I want to say a prayer for you. How many times have you had someone say, I'm going to keep you in my thoughts? I don't know exactly what that means, keeping you in your thoughts, but it's a very inactive thing, right? Let me just park that up there. I'll think about it a little bit more. But when someone says, I'm going to pray for you, I don't care if you're an atheist, if you're a Muslim, if you're Jewish, if you're Hindu, I don't care what you are. If someone says, I'm praying for you, there's something comforting in the fact that someone is doing something actively for you, that they care enough about you that they're going to do that. And I don't care who it is in my organization. I'll do it all the time. I do it all the time to people below me, above me, tell them I'm going to pray for them. The other thing I do is I share what I call my four epical moments. These are immensely personal things that I share with people that are a reflection of who I am. An epic is just an event in your life that's changed who you are. And Brian often says that the fifth epical moment in my life was me meeting him. But I don't generally share that publicly, Brian. Sorry, man. But the fourth one that I share, I'm not going to go into them, but the fourth one I share is the story of my daughter, which is extremely personal. And it's interesting because I've told the story so often that I kind of get numb to how powerful it is inside of me. And I got choked up yesterday when I started talking about it because it just reminds me of what I went through then. But part of the story there is I was not, in those first 33 years of my life, anyone I was proud of. I was not the man of faith I wanted to be. I was not the husband I wanted to be. I was not the father I wanted to be. And I even hate to say that out loud, but it's true. It's very true. And so what I tell people at the end of that story, because of this, you know, there was a silver lining in every tragedy. I'm a man of faith. Now, I fall short every day, but I'm a man of faith, and I try my best. And that's what God asks of me. I'm a better husband, I think, and I'm a better father, I think. You'll have to ask my wife and kids about that, but I think I am. And I share that with people, and it's interesting because people respond back to me in big ways. I've gotten some of the most incredible emails, handwritten notes, one-on-one conversations with people who felt touched enough that they would reach out to me even though I didn't know them. In fact, I keep something I call a smile file. Does anyone else have a smile file? All right, a few of you. I'm not the only dork in the world that keeps a smile file, as Brian reminds me of all the time. But I use this smile file when I'm having a particularly bad day. I pull it out, and I read these notes that people have sent me, and they give me courage, and they reinforce my faith, and they reinforce why I do what I do. It reminds me of why I do what I do, and that's why I lean out there and share, because I'm able to connect with people on a deeply personal level, even though I don't know who they are. Even though I don't know who they are. So you can do that too, no matter what you do. The second thing I'd share with you is that to really connect with people, having true humility and vulnerability makes a connection like you can't imagine. And that's countercultural in the business world, to be humble and vulnerable. It really is. There's a lot of false humility out there. There's a lot of false vulnerability, but if you do it truly from your heart and from a position of faith, it really connects with people. And during the James series, Brian had a slide up of Jamie Dimon, who's the CEO of one of the largest U.S. banks, who just went through the $2 billion loss because of a trading issue in Europe. And he very publicly came out and said, "We screwed up. Buck stops with me. I'm accountable. We're going to get it right." Now, that was very countercultural. I have no idea what Jamie Dimon's faith is. I don't know if he's a man of faith. But I know it's very countercultural, and I want to know more about why did he come out so publicly and say what he said. That's a very unique thing to do in the business world. So my example was a few years ago when I was running our North American baby care business. Any Pampers users in the crowd? Brian was hawking auto insurance. This week I'm hawking diapers. But when I was running our North American baby care business, we had a situation where commodity costs were rising rapidly and we had to take a price increase. Now, you're all consumers and you buy products, and we think very seriously about it because we want to give you the very best product at the very best value. So we take those very seriously. We want people, if they're going to pay more, to get more from that. So we deliberated 3 months and went through a ton of analysis, and half my team was saying, yes, do it, and half my team was saying no. And I remember I made the call. I said, we're going to take this price increase. And literally, from the minute we took it, bad things started to happen on that business. In fact, it was one of those bad things where I was getting the offer of help from many senior leaders in the company. Those phone calls that their names popped up, and I'm like, I should just let that go through to voicemail type of calls. And I remember, though, that it was very clear, and I knew what I had to do. We had to rescind the pricing. Now, the way the math works on this is if you're dropping the price down and commodities are rising, I have to sell more to make up that profit shortfall that I was going to have. And if I didn't, if my business continued to do the exact same thing, I was going to miss my profit expectations by an amount that would be a material impact on the company's earnings, because we were that big of a business. So I had to go all the way up to our then CEO with my boss, and I had my one-page Proctor memo prepared, slid it over there, and I thought we were going to have a long conversation, but he actually had one sentence for me. He said, "You better be right." Now, at P&G, there's another part of that sentence which goes unspoken, which is, you better be right, because if you're not, there'll be a memo in about 6 months that'll say Kirk L. Perry has decided to leave the company to pursue other interests. That kind of right. And so as I was driving home that night, I was really struggling, thinking, God, you know, what do I say to my team? Because half of them are going to be, you know, saying, gosh, he's going to come in looking for somebody to pin this on. It was really his decision. The other half are going to be disappointed because they didn't want to take pricing. Now they're going to have to do the work to go back and undo it. And I laid in bed, and I'm not one of those guys who hears the voice of God. I think God talks to me through other people, but I'm like, hey, if you can do your best Morgan Freeman and, you know, use that voice and tell me what I should do, it'll be clear I know it's you. Come on, God, work with me. But you know what? I saw a word in my head. I saw a word, like, close my eyes, and it was apologize. I'm like, apologize? What are you talking about, apologize? What do you mean by that, God? And I'm a slow learner. Obviously, it took me 33 years to find my true faith, and it took a shocking event to do that, so I'm a bit of a slow learner. So as I was driving to work the next morning, I figured out, well, what God seems to be telling me to do is I'm going to walk into a room where people are going to be on very different places, and I can walk in and do something very different and apologize, countercultural, salt and light. How do I give a different flavor? So I walked into the meeting. The first thing I said was, I apologize. I made a mistake. I made the decision to take this pricing, and it didn't work. What I'm going to ask for is your help. The company needs you. I need you. And we've got to turn this thing around. You could feel the tension leave the room. But the most interesting thing happened after the meeting. One of my direct reports came into my office, and he said to me, "Wow, you must be really confident that we can deliver what you promised." I'm like, "Not at all. I don't know." And I could see his face, like, "Are you kidding me? I'm following this guy, and I'm hitching my cart to this horse, and he's saying he's not confident. Oh my gosh!" I could just see it in his face. And I said, "Now, I'm not confident if I'm right or wrong, but I'm confident in one thing: that whether I'm right or wrong, my God and my family are still going to love me. My God and my family are still going to love me. So I may make bad decisions in business, but at the end of the day, the people that matter most are still going to love me." What ensued over the next, to this day, several years, were amazing faith conversations, because I took a chance and was vulnerable and humble in how I approached a bad decision that I took. The third thing is, invest in people you don't need to get yourself ahead. Now, I'm going to give you a sentence, and I bet you most of you can fill in the blank. It's not what you know, it's who you know. Another maxim of business, right? All you got to do is focus on those guys above you and take care of them, and they'll pull you along. They'll lift you up as they climb, so the saying goes. But you know, when you look at the life of Jesus, who did he hang around with? He hung around with sinners, with tax collectors, with fishermen, not exactly the pillars of society in that day. In fact, if he wanted to do the who you know part of that, he would have hung out with the Pharisees and the Sadducees and the religious leaders of the Jewish world back then, because if you want to transmit a message and prove that you're the Son of God, why wouldn't you go right to the top? Why wouldn't you go to the guys that really matter, who you know? And he didn't. He chose to work with a very different crowd. And so I try to do that because I think everybody wants to feel valued and really wants to be part of something bigger than themselves. And they want to know you notice them and you care about them. So I'll read you a quick email that I got 7 years ago. It has a nice circuitous ending here. "Hey, Kirk, I met you in the Groom's Road corridor before the holidays. You may recall that we found out during our conversation that we were both originally from Detroit. I wanted to let you know you made a very positive impact on me that day. Your warmth and sincerity, along with the fact that you initiated the conversation, was touching and refreshing. From a big picture standpoint, most employees would never initiate a conversation with a vice president during a chance encounter. To have that person initiate it is surprising, but your personal warmth adds much more and touches on a deeper level. You didn't talk about work or business, which is on all of our minds. For a moment during a busy day, we were just two coworkers talking about the upcoming holidays. Thanks again for those few moments of connection. Reggie Brown." Fast forward to October-ish of 2010 at a last Wednesday service. We had a baptismal service that night. I remember looking out and seeing people go through, and I saw a guy slip and fall into the baptismal tub. And that guy that slipped and fell in was Reggie Brown. Now, I do not know if I planted a seed, if I watered it. I don't know what happened that day. But all I know is I made a connection with the guy who 5 years later made a connection with the Lord. And I think whether or not you connect it directly doesn't matter. If you're doing the Lord's work and you're showing your faith, things like that happen. Things like that do happen. And the last point I'll leave you with is stand firm in your faith. Stand firm in your faith. Now, what does that mean? Because, you know, in the business world, unlike in Jesus' time, when you stood firm in your faith, you got killed. You got killed. You were martyred. Not a good way to end it. And I don't think in the business world I'm going to be martyred. But I do know that standing firm in your faith does matter. And here's a quick example for me. Several years ago when I transitioned to a new organization, I was doing my join up, sharing much like I'm doing right now in terms of who I am, my epical moments, a few videos, making connections. I thought it went exceedingly well. After the meeting, people came up to me. "Oh my gosh, that was great. It's great to had new things I put in my smile file. All was good." My smile file. And then a few weeks later, one of my bosses at the time grabbed me in the hallway. He's like, "Hey, how'd your join up go?" I said, "Oh, I think it went great. I had all these notes and people seemed to be connected and got some great feedback." He said, "Yeah, I was meaning to talk to you about that." I said, "You know, Kirk, you're going to rise to levels higher than you are right now in the organization. And everything you say and do is going to be scrutinized to a much greater degree, much greater degree. So every word you say, every personal thing you share, people are going to pull apart and they're trying to connect something to that. So less is more. And I would really think about how you share." And I was taken aback because I knew exactly what this person was trying to get at. don't share who you are, really, because we don't want to hear it, but we don't know that other people want to hear it either. And I remember going home that night and laying in bed with my wife, and I was hopping mad. I'm like, how dare that person give me that feedback? And I'm a believer, though, that if somebody gives you feedback, even though it's 1% truth, it's 99% real to them. And so my wife, who is full of wisdom and far more wisdom-filled than I am, said, stand firm in your faith. Stand firm in your faith. Believe in what you do. Believe in what you say. So I went into this individual, and we had a follow-up conversation. I said, you know, thank you for the feedback. I've taken it. I've thought about it. But here's the deal with me. I am who I am. I'm not going to hide who I am. I'm not going to not share things because I believe I'm connecting with people on a much deeper level, and they're going to want to work harder for me and make a connection here at work, and it's important to me. And if you're saying I can't do that, maybe this isn't the place for me. Maybe it's not where I belong. And then it was like this unrewind. Well, that's not what I meant, and what I said was this. And so whether or not I misinterpreted what they said or whether they intended to say what they did or not is really irrelevant. What is relevant is I stood firm in my faith. Now, if I would have taken those comments at face value and would have walked out of there and never said again my four epical moments or those things that are important to me, I would have put my light under a shade. I would not have been salty at all. I would not have revealed the part of me that's very important to me and important to God. And so as you think about these things, they may or may not connect with you, but regardless of what level you are in the organization, regardless of what you do for a living, you can share your faith. Jesus is very clear. He asks us to be salt, and he asks us to be light. And so as we think about this week, figure out a way to be a little bit saltier and a little more illuminated when you go into what you do every day.
Well done. Yeah, it gets better every time. I did notice, though, you kept talking about the smile file. You know, I didn't see many men raise their hands. I mean, so how long have you been shaving your legs? That's one of the questions that we have, you know.
Let me tell you something. Here's what he's not telling you. He's got two files, and they're both pretty thick. The first one is inappropriate things said in public. The second one is the number of people I've spit on in the front row. Okay? That's all I'm saying, Brian. That's all I'm saying.
Oh, good. Hey, one question follow-up. A band comes out. We're going to do one little brief little thing in a moment here. But some would say, well, Kirk, you're high up on the ladder. You can pretty much say anything you want because, you know, you've got a level of power in your organization. Do you think that these same things apply to somebody who is, you know, lower on the ladder, has a little less power?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I share a story often. I was in one of our manufacturing plants in the Midwest, and I used video clips to illustrate points. And in one of these video clips I used, there was a guy in the video clip that used God's name in vain. So after the meeting was over, there were a couple people waiting to talk to me, and he came up to me and said, I know you're a believer. You've never said it, but I know it just by things you say. And he said, do me a favor next time if you're a believer. Please don't use videos with the Lord's name in vain on them. Hmm. This guy was a technician, worked on one of our manufacturing lines in the middle of the U.S., but he had the guts, the courage to stand firm in his faith. Hmm. So I think regardless of where you are, you can make faith a part of who you are at work.
Would you pray for us just right now?
Absolutely. Hey, God, we are so grateful to be part of your family. We are so grateful that you call us to be the salt and the light of the earth. It is such an incredible opportunity for us to show people your glory and your greatness. And I just ask, Lord, as we go forth this week, that in our workplace, in our schools, in whatever environment we interact with people, help us be a little saltier. Help us be a little more lighted, Lord, because we want to show people how great you are. And it's in your Son's name that I say these things. Amen.
And let's thank Kirk for helping us and being very vulnerable today. Amazing. Thank you.